From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. Tonight, lexicographer, linguist, and language historian, Professor Stefan Dollinger of the Department of English. And I'm delighted, Stefan, to have you here on the program. Welcome.
Hello, Ira. It's great to be here.
Let's begin with lexicography. How do you define this term? It seems quite a mouthful.
It is indeed, but it's a wonderful word. Lexicography can best be defined as the art and craft of making dictionaries. So you have a skill set there, the crafty aspect, and then the artsy aspect as well. So you need to combine both. And of course, there's a bit of science as well there now. So,
is it reasonable to ask, when did dictionaries begin?
Oh, yes. I mean, the history of dictionary making has been well researched in English, usually the year 1604, so right around the time when Shakespeare died. He was still writing at the time. Is actually the date that is placed as the beginning of English dictionaries. A man named Cawdrey put together a word list in a bound format, and that was the innovation. There had been word lists before, but that was the first one. And that dictionary looked quite different from the ones that we are used to, because it included exclusively words that were difficult to understand. It didn't have any everyday words.
Did it have pronunciation guides?
No, nothing like that. It's just a word and then the more easily comprehensible translation or version of it.
So in the classical world, in the world of Greek and Roman oratory writing, there were no dictionaries?
They were not in the bound book form as such. So you had word lists, but the innovation at the time was really that you had something that is bound with a cover that you could take away with. And Cawdrey was the first one for English.
Many people think of Dr. Johnson when we bring up the topic of dictionaries. How significant was he in terms of the evolution of the dictionary in English?
Well, Johnson was the important literary figure in the 18th century, and the fact that he wrote a dictionary helped him achieve that status. He did a lot of things right, like he looked for attestations of words in established authors. He did background research, but he didn't innovate those things. Like, there were people before him, Nathaniel Bailey is one name, in the 1730s, that introduced a lot of new features that then Johnson sort of integrated into his own work.
But it seems that early dictionaries were the result of individuals rather than institutions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Johnson's, he was paid by the booksellers. Then he got the money, and he had basically little idea what to do, but he just came up with a plan. And then there were delays and delays. And that is something that is very typical for lexicography, that things always take much longer than people anticipate. The Oxford English Dictionary is a good example. In 1857, they thought it would take 10 years. Well, in 1928, they finally had it ready.
Well, these things take time, as you say.
They do take time, indeed.
Yes. But it seems like the evolution of dictionaries may be partly the story of moving from individuals to institutions, and frequently publishers and or universities that support the work of dictionaries. Is that a reasonable characterization?
I think that it's fair to say, definitely, yes. I mean, by the time the Oxford English Dictionary was planned, it was clear that not one single person could do that. So you had to come up with a scheme for a collaborative effort, funding models, and that, of course, took all time to be developed. In Germany, the Grimm brothers did one famous dictionary before the Oxford English Dictionary in the 1830s. It was started, and that was sort of established the model for the historical dictionaries that then the OED took on, and it went from there.
So I also understand you are now the editor-in-chief of the second edition of A Dictionary of Canadianisms. What are some of the challenges that you face in taking on this particular role and shaping or reshaping this dictionary?
Well, funding is one of the big issues. The time of dictionary making has passed. And you really need to argue quite well and convincingly why another dictionary should be funded. Now, in our case, it's we bring a new methodology to the table. So if you want to find out what a Canadianism is, you always need to contrast Canadian data with American and British and other Englishes. So it's a lot of work that needs to be done. And we use digital sources, the internet with a statistical way of detecting Canadian words, meanings, and phrases. And then the next problem was that you have to find able staff to be able to help you, because you know it's impossible to do it alone. So I was very lucky that I had colleagues at UBC English in Professor Laura Brinton and Professor Marjorie Fee that were eager and widely read. And then the students, of course. So the students here are brilliant, and there have been about 45 students that have been working with us since 2006.
And how far along are you?
We expect
another 10 years?
No. We expect to be finished at the beginning of 2016. So we're almost on target.
Who is going to use this dictionary, and why would one use it?
Everybody who's interested in English in Canada and beyond. If you're interested to know, I mean, there's all sorts of word lists out there. People telling you that toque is Canadian, people telling you that A is Canadian, but rarely they tell you why. And there's a lot of information out there that is just not correct. So for the terms that we have included, we'll give people, that's the first, pretty much all the information that we have, we tell them why a particular term, meaning, or expression is Canadianism. There are six types that we established, and then we tell what we call a word story, which is a less fancy way of saying etymology, but we really argue our case, and then people can agree or not agree, improve on it. So it has sort of it's not a wiki as such, but it has this wiki component to it that we really open our vault and say, look, this is what we use for our assessment, believe it or make it better.
Can you give an example of a Canadianism that has been particularly problematic or intriguing or misunderstood?
The most intriguing ones I find to be the ones that you don't realize are Canadian at all. And most often these are compound nouns. So two independent words like cube and van, they're not Canadian at all. But once you combine them and use them in conjunction, just as in the word cube van, you'll find that this is distinctly Canadian. It's something that, it's a type of moving truck, right? And when we crunch the data and look at the information, then we'll see that it's used most widely in central Canada, in Ontario and Quebec, with another peak in Alberta, and now to some extent here in BC as well. So we're trying to model variation in the language in both regional and in social ways as far as we can do that.
Is there a graphic component to the dictionary?
There
I mean,
is.
You've just described,
yes,
you know, regions. So could I quickly look at some infographic which is going to show me quickly that, yes, it's very used more often in central Canada than western Canada?
Yeah, this would be shown in the form of a normalized frequency chart. So you see the provinces, and you see the frequencies that the term occurs with in those regions. Yeah, so it's a one-glance thing.
All right, it sounds pretty exciting. Now, of course, you're a linguist as well, and I know that a while ago you did a paper called Vancouver Vernacular, the Western Canada-U.S. Border as a Linguistic Boundary. What is Vancouver Vernacular?
The Vancouver vernacular. Vernacular is the form of language that is spoken in a particular location that is not necessarily the standard language. It's sort of the common core form of linguistic communication. And what I did in this study is I contrasted Vancouver English based on 32 linguistic variables. So things like, do people say groceries or groceries, do they use A or not, those things. And I contrasted this with data from across the border in Washington State. And what we found is that despite some ideas that Vancouver English or Canadian English in the bigger context might be dying out, it is holding its ground. And it's quite interesting when you look at why that's the case. I mean, we've been using traditional Canadian variables. And it's not so much the Canadian-born Canadians that uphold those traditional forms, but it's the second language newcomers that seem to adopt those traditional prestige variants and carry them forward. So that's sort of the interesting aspect here, that there is a contribution in Vancouver English of second language speakers of English.
That is quite fascinating. But how do you do the field research for this? Do you walk around Bellingham with a tape recorder?
That's one way of doing it. We did this for another study that we're just working on. There are changes in the what's called the front vowels, so things like kit and dress and bat. There's a Canadian way of saying them. And those changes are very subtle. So you need to come up with your scientific methodology and carry out frequent measurements and that kind of stuff, and then normalize them. And, you know, it's all very technical then. But once you do this, then you really find that there are distinct differences in that level too. So it's not just the little words and the phonemic incidences and, you know, a kind of lexical choices, whether, you know, you say garburator or something else for that kind of thing. But it's also in the sound level. They're subtle, but they're there and they're consistent. So that's one way of collecting data. The other one is you can do it via online questionnaires. They used to give them out in paper. Now we can do it on the internet. And the upside of this is that you can get hundreds of responses in fairly little time. And that's really very
valuable. Isn't it important and crucial to actually hear the sound of people pronouncing these words?
For some issues like the front vowels that form the Canadian vowel shift, it is paramount. There's no way doing this on a questionnaire. But if somebody calls a woolen hat a toque, a hat or a beanie, that you can ask them via the questionnaires.
I haven't heard beanie for a long time.
Yeah, it's a New Zealand term.
How did you become interested in this entire field, both lexicography and linguistic study?
Well, I think I told you this before, but I wanted to be originally an engineer. And then I wanted to become a literature scholar. And when you go to school in Austria, where I went to school, you need to do both linguistics and literature when you study a foreign language. So I took English, and even though I was going for the literature angle, it was always the linguistics courses where I really scored very high. So at some point I sat down, I thought maybe I should do something with the engineering background, really go into linguistics, and I've never regretted it since.
And it's a field which is constantly evolving.
Absolutely.
And changing. Mm-hmm. And updating, which leads me in part to the Oxford English Dictionary, which is indeed such an institution. Mm-hmm. Internationally. Mm-hmm. And I believe you were invited last year to a conference somewhat analyzing the current nature and future of the dictionary. What's your sense of the dictionary as a project? Is it evolving? Is it keeping up with the times, to use that cliche, or is it stuck in the 19th century?
Mired in the 19th century. Well, it's a tough question. I mean, what I can tell you is that the editors of the Oxford English Dictionary are trying their hardest to make the OED relevant to the present day. The problem that they're facing is that the original OED was a brainchild of the mid-19th century. So the focus was on literary language, on the written text, right? And even to today, about 50% of all the entries in the OED online are based on that 19th century, early 20th century database. So the problem that they're facing now is the length of time that it takes to revise the dictionary. So when it was completed finally in 1928 in the first edition, the first thing they did is they published a supplement, another volume in addition to the original 12 volumes. And then after 1933, when that volume was published, nothing much happened for 20 years, at which point a new editor was appointed, and the result of this was four additional volumes between 1972 and 1986. Now, at this point, we're in the mid-80s, and paper dictionaries were sort of still the rage. but people realize that maybe we need to do something more with the digital end of things. Now, what you do if you have a dictionary, which was then 20 volumes on paper, on print plates, 5 million 5 by 6 inch paper slips, that's your back file. What do you do with that kind of stuff? So at the point when John Simpson, who was editor from 1993 until just last year, took over, the big thing was how to make this thing digital, how to kind of move this bit by bit into the digital world. And to his credit, they started with a CD-ROM in 1989. And then they moved on to the internet later on. So in 2000, the whole thing was on the internet. So at that point, they decided to revise the OED one more time, and they thought they'd take another 10 years. And we talked about the lengthy delays. It's now 2014, and they've revised the letter M, in which they start, all the way through R, at which point they decided to go a non-alphabetical sequence, and now so sort of they have maybe 30% revised 13 years into the game. So the problem is now when you have a big lexicon like the OED of about 600,000 words, and there are a lot of words that are not particularly interesting, right? But they need to be described: desk, cook, spoon, those sort of things, right? But you know, there are words that are more interesting, like twerking or tweeting or those kind of things, right? So what do you do with the not so interesting words? And I guess you have to choose your battles. And since the OED is a privately funded by the press, by Oxford University Press, privately funded project, you need to pick your battles. And so the new editor, Michael Prophet, is now trying to negotiate these sort of different expectations into the OED. And I'm following this closely, because I'm not quite sure which way they are going, and I certainly wouldn't want to be in his kind of shoes.
Well, I'm trying to imagine how they decide to include or exclude. In the end, is there a sort of editorial board? They have recommendations from linguists, scholars from around the world, or maybe not around the world, and then it's a question of raise your right hand if you want this word in or not. How does it happen?
Excellent question. No, it's not that democratic, I think I can say. An advisory board is something that I think they might be going this way now. I mean, this future of the OED conference was the first time when the OED reached out and asked scholars that were independent of the OED. So I think this is really much to their credit. It takes a lot of guts and a lot of willpower to move an institution in a different direction. I think that's what they've been starting here. So really, kudos to the OED for that. But traditionally, you never quite know why one word makes it in and another one doesn't. There are internal guidelines, which I haven't seen, but they are sometimes referred to. So it's more a question of selecting. And that used to be easier until fairly recently, when you say, okay, what I want to do is I want to document literary English. So I use the language of the good writers, whatever they are, right? Or whoever they are, rather, and then I'll document their word usage. Huh? Now, with the colloquialization of English, it's a new genre is coming up, and the idea that the spoken language, which has been researched heavily for 50 years now, that the spoken language should be included as well, you sort of open a Pandora's box. English is in a particular case here that's very interesting, because English is now a very odd language in comparison to all the 6,000 other languages in the world, because it's the one language that is spoken by more second language speakers than by first language speakers. And the ratio is about 5-1 or 6-1 now. So therefore, every 5 second language speakers in the world, there is one native speaker of English. So the question you need to ask yourself with these figures is, how are we going to revise the OED going forward? Do we want to stick with the old principles, and I think this would be a mistake, or do we want to adapt it and reflect its true global reach and nature? And that's a very scary one for the OED, because it would mean to really change radically the procedure of making the dictionary. You would look at, you know, the language used by the Swedish engineer talking to the Japanese engineer, you would document English as lingua franca, which is now the most widely spoken form of English. I mean, this is just a fact, right? But it's a scary one. And the OED has always been a British institution. I mean, it's on the top 50 list of British icons, right? So that's one thing. But at the same time, it has tried to capture world Englishes. And what they have now is they have mostly the inner circle, so, I mean, the former settler colonies, English is documented. So it's sort of, you know, it's always been, neither fish nor fowl. And so those are very difficult decisions to be making. And what I tried to show them is that the lingua franca global aspects of English are really important.
I never had a sense of the geopolitics of dictionaries, but you've made that very, very clear. So I must finally ask you if you have a favorite word. And by favorite, I mean a word that you always come back to because you're trying to trace its origin, its development, or its meaning that keeps shifting. And it's a word that keeps you up at night.
Well, lots of words that keep me up at night. Do I have a favorite one? You know, I kind of sometimes I said certain words, but I think at this point I don't have a clear favorite, and I need to just say they're all beautiful as they are.
Okay. Well, many thanks to Professor Stefan Dollinger, linguist, lexicographer, and member of the UBC Department of English. It's really been a great pleasure, and stay tuned for future episodes of UBC Arts on Air.
The Vancouver International Dance Festival returns for the